Hello, good morning. I've lost my voice. That's why I sound like a mouse or something. I'm going to try and project as much as possible. If you, for some reason, you stop hearing, just put your hand up and then I'll shout. Can you hear me like this? Is that all right? You're not interested in hearing me. Can you hear me like that? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, here we go. This lecture, as I announced last week, will be on Valentine Cunningham. But actually, what I'm going to do is wrap up the module, think big picture, what we have done so far, what can you take away from modes of reading, and then relate everything we've done so far to the second assessed essay that you will be writing over Easter. Okay. So it's entitled After Theory because that's the text that we are reading an excerpt from today. So I've chosen to end this module with an essay by Valentine Cunningham, which is entitled Touching Reading, because I think that the questions that he raises coincide with the concerns on this module. So the plan for the lecture looks like this. I'm going to talk about where we started on modes of reading, that's our beginnings, how we can use the knowledge that we acquired on modes of reading practically, that's the practical, and then to think about where we got so far. And then I'm going to link it all to the essays. So beginnings, where did we start? The very first lecture on modes of reading established the context through which we wanted you to read the primary texts. At the start of the year, I made a very clear announcement about what we wanted you to do on this module. And this is a summary of what I said in the first lecture, because it's very important to see where we started to understand why this module is structured the way it is. I said in the first lecture that we wanted you to read a primary text, then we wanted you to read some theory, then we wanted you to ask critical questions. And I gave you a set of six critical questions. I'm going to go through them because those are the six critical questions that we're going to use when I explain how to decode essay titles and write your essay. I said you could ask questions such as, what cultural problem is being set up when you pick up a primary text? Why might readers at a particular time and place find this work compelling? I hope you can see now that question number two invites you to become a new historicist reader. This is what Greenblatt does. Are there differences between my values and the values implicit in the text? And if there are differences, do I want to uphold those differences? Do I want to change the way I think? This is about ideological reading. What kind of cultural intervention is this text making? These are Marxist questions. These are structuralist questions. How does this text position me as reader? That is, what assumptions must you have to be an insider on this text? This is reader response theory. What is the text setting up as normative? And what is being set up against the normative as different? This is what the feminist critics ask. What are these linked to class, ideology, race, gender, sexual behavior, etc., and in what ways? I also told you in that lecture that question number six can be broken down into further questions, such as, how is the text constructing the categories of woman, female? Is it always in opposition to man, male? Is it constructing the category of woman in relation to other women who are seen as normative? How is the text constructing man, male? Is there any other social unit being privileged in the text? For example, is there any geographical, historical, or ideological location that is being privileged? That's, of course, what Buell talks about, what Raymond Williams talks about. You will note from these questions that I was inviting you to think about the text, about its relationship to the world around it, and about your relationship to it. At no point did I say that you should ask who wrote it, how old were they, what was their religion, what was their gender, what was their sexual orientation. I did not ask you to direct your attention to the author. And of course, this coincides with the lectures we've just heard on the death of the author and the opportunities that that kind of reading offers you. So as the module progressed, we read primary texts, we read theory, we had seminars on the text, then we had seminars on the theory, we practiced how to do close reading in the first formative essay, and then we practiced how to write a research piece. Where are we now? Well, we are now at the most crucial point in your very first year of undergraduate studies, because it is at this point, it's today, in week 10, that things should start falling into place. I like to think of modules like books. Modules are like very long 19th century novels, 500 pages plus. Modules only make sense after you finish them, because that's when all the pieces fall together. If you've ever read Tom Jones from beginning to end, well done. If you've ever read those really huge Dickens novels from beginning to end, well done. You'll know when you've read those very long 19th century novels that what you're doing when you're reading, if it takes you 19 weeks to read, is collecting information. That's all you're doing. Every chapter of that book gives you a clue. And it's only when you get to the end that you have to sit back and think, where, what does it all mean? How does it all fall in place? 19 weeks on modes of reading, that's how long you've spent on this module. Every week you heard a different voice. This is a polyphonic novel. Isn't that great? It really is. Every week some theorist from some part of the world shouted his opinions and her opinions at us, and we engaged with them. People in my seminar group sometimes get really angry immediately before they engage with the critic, and they say, this is nonsense. That's okay. And I say, wait, listen first. Engage with the critic, then say it's nonsense. Now is your time to engage with all the critics, put them all together, let them make sense. And this is what this lecture is about. We're going to think today about what do we do with the 19 weeks of people just saying things to us. Okay, so what does it all mean? What does it amount to? There is no single privileged reading that we prioritize on modes of reading. At no point did we say that a particular set of lectures were the mode of reading that we're encouraging. And you should not, this is a personal but a very well-informed opinion, you should not adopt a particular mode of reading. Don't become a slave, a disciple, a parrot of theory. Don't spend the rest of your 3 years at Warwick saying, being a Marxist critic, I'm only... No, don't be anybody yet. There's so many voices, I hope, that are going on in your head. I hope you feel loads of theorists are actually talking to you anytime you pick up a novel. Do you feel that yet? I hope so. This explains why we're what we are, because there's so many people talking in our heads. This module is about options. And the more options you are given to read a text, the richer your reading is. So if you were to go back now and read Raymond Williams, which was the essay we read in week 2, you're not going to read Raymond Williams in the same way, because you are not the same reader. And that's really important to emphasize. Don't feel, oh, I read Kristeva. No, we didn't do Kristeva. Irigaray. I read Irigaray, didn't understand her, off we go. No, you are a different reader every time. And here's what you've learned. I'm going to show you a list of what we've done to see how many voices are going on inside your head. We've done De Saussure and Freud. That was my first lecture. Williams and Greenblatt. Jameson, Marx and Engels. Buell and Fanon, Happy Days. Spivak, Said, Zizek, Hall and Butler. Wolff, De Beauvoir and Schweikart. Sixou, Irigaray, Weeks, Sedgwick, Rose, Shklovsky, which I'm sure has a lot of fans in here, Jakobson, Barthes, Foucault, Iser and Fish, and for this week, Cunningham and Eagleton. If I were sitting in your place right now, I'd feel really proud if I've read all of them. And this is what I would know. This is how I would use all this information. Every time I read a text, this is what goes on in my mind. I would know and you know that language is a social, language is social, and speech is individual. I know this not only from de Saussure, I know it from the accumulation of theories that I've read this year. Language is essential because it's the mode with which we express ourselves, but speech is ancillary and more or less accidental. Language itself is not a function of the speaker. It's the product that is passively registered by the individual. Language does not require premeditation, but speech is an act of will. It's the combination through which the speaker uses the code provided by language in order to express his thoughts. Speech is about codes. So if I'm listening to speech, if I'm reading somebody's speech, I'm not just reading the language. I need to decode the speech because speech is loaded with codes. Language is a social institution. It's a system of signs that expresses ideas, and therefore it's comparable to writing. So all of us in the room have acquired language, but we don't all use the same speech. All the characters in McInnes's novel have acquired language, but it is their speech that gives them an identity. So if I were sitting in your place, I would look at speech. I would decode the speech. I would decode the signs in a speech. I also know from the Freud essay that I lectured on in week one that Freud talks about manifest and latent meaning, obvious and hidden meaning. And I know that every time I see a dream, for example, in a novel, I need to think about manifest, that is obvious elements, as well as latent, secret, and repressed elements. We have seen dreams. We have to pause and ask, how are they being used in the narrative? But I also ask, from my knowledge of Freud, what aspects of this text have been repressed? What aspects are being alluded to and made inaccessible? That's what Sedgwick was talking about. What aspects are being repressed and why? I'm not going to go through all the theories. This is just to give you an example of how I use them. From Raymond Williams, I learned that literature has shifting meanings. Of course, I'll post the PowerPoint presentation on the website, so don't feel you have to copy the slides. I learned that literature has shifting meanings and performs different functions at different points of economic development. That's what I need to remember from Raymond Williams. It's about economic development. Who participates in the economy and who's kept out of the economy? Williams taught me to look at the relationship between country and city and to read it as a relation not only of ideas and experiences, but of rent and interest, of situation and power, to look at the relationship as part of a wider system. So I have already thought of Williams in relation to Colin McInnes because Pablo lectured on Williams and Colin McInnes. But I could also think of Williams in relation to The Magic Toy Shop. And I can think of it as a novel that represents economic dependence. Isn't that obvious to you now? It's a novel that represents total economic dependence on a patriarch. And I need to analyze the relationship of powers in it because of my understanding of how William sets up those relationships of power. But also, I could consider the representation of London in The Magic Toy Shop and understand where that whole weird red family, etc., is positioned in that London of the 1960s, of the late 1960s. And this is my final example now. I've also learned that new historicist critics, such as Stephen Greenblatt, for example, would want me to ask a whole different set of questions. So I wear my Greenblatt hat when I'm reading primary text, and I ask, what would it have been like to have lived at the time of the Beat Generation when I'm reading Howl. Why does Ginsberg speak the way he does? If I'm reading through new historicist eyes, I would pay attention to the specific discourses and signifying codes of a particular historical period. So I would research the effects of Hiroshima on the morale of Americans at the time that Howl was published. I would read firsthand accounts of the aftermath of the bomb. I would also think about the political restrictions that were imposed on artists who were seen as a threat to national security, so I can understand the constant references to the CIA, to seeing the great minds of his generation being shattered by the public. So you see how much you're capable of doing just by using the theories as strategies. You are now capable of wearing all these different hats and of generating so many different meanings for each text you've read. So what Modes of Reading has encouraged you to do is precisely what Valentine Cunningham wants you to do. You see, when I was being taught English literature and literary theory at school, every time I'd go into a module, I would know exactly what kind of ideological position I was expected to inhabit for a whole year. So I remember reading Keats, Byron, Wordsworth, that was a dreadful module, because I hate poetry, of course. Keats, Byron, Shelley, Wordsworth, and Blake from a Marxist perspective for the whole year, because the tutor was a Marxist. Then, happy days, I take some novels, Bronte, Eliot, and Austen, everybody gets married, but it's just feminist reading every week. Where are the women? What's wrong with the women? Why are men so bad? Okay, we get it. This is quite an outdated way of teaching literature. It is not about adopting a stance and sticking to it. We don't want you to do that. So, get quite excited about this. Years of my life. So, Modes of Reading is a module which does specifically what Valentine Cunningham wants us to do, that is to concentrate on the pursuit of the human within the unpromising. He's obviously quite sarcastic about theorists, and you have to read his essays bearing that in mind. He's a great character. When he comes to work all the time, he's one of our external examiners, and when he comes and talks about a student's essay, he treats students like critics, and he will say, "This critic here," so, you know, behave like critics, and he's very sarcastic about people who just parrot other people's words. So he says that we need to emphasize the pursuit of the human within the unpromising theoretical labyrinths of text and dissemination. You see that word unpromising? Theory, all of these theories are like labyrinths. They're unproductive. They're just tools. They're not the way to read the text. Cunningham tells us that the reading, the act of reading, can only proceed effectively, properly, he says, very controversial word, properly, truly, when much what theory alleges, and theory with a capital T, which means all of these theories, get up or has got up to, is left behind. Only when you leave the theory behind, you have to learn it, you have to understand it, you have to espouse these different theories for a while, but then you leave it behind. And I agree, that is absolutely right. We've spent 19 weeks doing theory, now it's time to get on with the reading. So we use theory to generate as many interpretations as possible, but we are not parrots. We are not disciples of these theorists. Our essays should not mimic or imitate. Our reading is informed by theory. Our reading is based on all the different perspectives that we gain from theory. But nonetheless, our reading is ours. That's what's original about it. That's why it's interesting. That's why I want to read your essays. I don't want to read your essays if you're just paraphrasing Irigaray. Not interested. This is not about knowledge accumulation. So, this is what you need to keep in mind. There's a book, there's me, There's theory, there's my reading. The most important aspect of this is me, us, and my reading. The book and the theory just hang around me, like people hang around Katie Price nowadays, doing her hair and eyebrows and makeup every time she says two words. So you are Katie Price in pink, and everything else revolves around you. Your essay is the most important thing you generate because it's you. Yes? Do you get it? Okay, great. So this leads me then to the essays, to my reading. What do I do to generate my reading? What I'm going to offer you now is strategy for how to construct the argument for your second assessed essay, which I'm sure you're all very keen to write. Yes? This is what you came here for. You're reading and you're writing. Then you read, then you write. If that's not what you want, you know, there's a law department somewhere else where people don't give their own opinions. So reading and writing, that's all we want from you. First question is, what is it that we want from you? Here are some criteria. If you fulfill them, you're really on the right track. I'm going to go through them in a minute. But basically, what our essay titles look like, they look like instructions. They're quite vague. There might be a quote that says, analyze, compare, etc. Mostly, they will say, discuss. What we're looking for when we mark them is relevance, logical structure, personal response and evaluation, and the way in which you use the primary text and the secondary sources. So the process I'm going to suggest to you looks like this. I'm going to go through the criteria in a moment. This is the process. Critical reading, critical thinking, critical writing. Critical reading, critical thinking, critical writing. The type of reading and thinking and writing that you do is what changes, but the process is always the same. And that's what I'm going to explain today. I'm going to give you a typical essay title and go through it, show you how we decode it and how we construct the argument. The first step is critical reading of the primary text, okay? We start with the primary text, not with the library. You don't go to the library until you're very far ahead in your thinking about the essay title. So the first thing you do is you go back to your primary text that you want to write on. And you generate problems from it. You ask questions. You read it with a pencil. You underline problems, things you don't understand, things that are exciting, gaps, similarities to other novels we've read or another poem that you know. You have to generate the problems. How do you do that? You ask the six critical questions that I showed you at the beginning of this lecture. Yeah? What's being set up as normative? What kind of worldview is this? What assumptions must I have in order to be an insider on this text, etc.? This is how you do the critical reading. You use critical questions. Then, once you understand how this text works, you decode the essay title. Here's a sample essay title. In Hanif Qureshi's The Buddha of Suburbia, individual growth and development are shown to be inseparable from social influences. Discuss. Sometimes we'll give you an essay title that involves a quotation. Sometimes it's an opinion. Sometimes it's a statement. And what we want you to do, first thing, is underline the keywords. Okay? And I've done this before in my essay writing sessions. From this essay title, the three keywords I will highlight are Buddha, shown, and inseparable. So I'm going to show you the essay title again. Buddha, because I need to know what text I'm being asked to write about, which is always a good idea. That satisfies relevance. And here we go. Shown and inseparable. Is that surprising for you, that those are the keywords? You're so cool. You're not easily surprised. That's okay. Okay. I didn't choose individual growth and development and social influences. The reason I didn't choose them is because in this statement, what I'm being told is not that I need to write an essay to show that the Buddha of... Oh, I'm not being told that I need to write an essay to show that Buddha of Suburbia is a novel about individual growth and development. That's not what the question is. If I were to write an essay to say, oh, look, Buddha of Suburbia, it's all about individual growth. It's a Bildungsroman. Zero. That's not the question. If I were to write an essay to say, in Buddha of Suburbia, music and popular culture play important roles. No, it's not about what. It's about how. So the key word here is show. And for me to understand how to approach this question, I need to understand what shown means. And there are two different ways to understand what show means. If something is shown to you, it means that you are watching. If you watch, you see things happen. You note the order in which things happen and the importance assigned to particular events. Taking this sense of something being shown to you, you would need to examine the narrative to see whether, in fact, the crucial things that happen in the growth and development of the central figure occur entirely and inevitably as a result of social influences. Do you get that? In other words, you need to reread the narrative to see if the things that happen are inseparable from the social influences. This would involve an examination of plot development. Not the plot, don't tell me the story, I know it. You need to examine plot development, narrative structure, and more widely, an analysis of genre. To understand this is a condition of England novel, what does that mean? But there is another sense for shown. Shown can also mean demonstrated, or proved. If read that way, the statement is saying that Koreishi's text is didactic, proving a deterministic case that character, which is shown through individual growth and development, is entirely determined, that is inseparable from, by environment, which are the social influences. So I'm going to read that again. There's another way of reading it by saying that this text is didactic and that the text demonstrates or proves the premise that character is entirely determined by environment. In other words, you could take the question to say it's inviting you to analyze whether it is being suggested that a particular philosophical position is being argued in this novel. So, for example, are we being guided to see characters as helpless victims of their environments, or are we being urged to judge them as moral agents with free will? Do you see what I'm saying here? What are the consequences of this novel? Is there a commentary woven into the narrative to help us decide one way or the other? And most importantly, how effective is this commentary? What tone does it take? And of course, here again, most important thing is to look at method. So one thing I want to emphasize at this point is the need to distinguish between what and how. It is easy to find the what of a text. That's what we do in seminars. We sit down and we look at the what. What happens? What does it mean? How does it compare to other novels? It's the what that we discuss together, you discuss with your friends. But it's more challenging to analyze the how. Telling us what a text is will give you a mediocre mark. But attempting to engage with how a text says it And to what extent is it successful in doing it? That's what's original. That's what's going to give you the first class mark. Okay, so you've read the text. You've identified the keywords. Second step you need to do is paraphrase the title. This is the critical writing, the planning stage. Identify the keywords. Make sure you know what the keywords are. I would suggest agree with your seminar tutor. Do I understand this essay title properly? Then you rewrite the title. By rewriting it, you generate your thesis statement. Each one of you will paraphrase the title differently. This is how you paraphrase it. You say, I want to discuss how. By putting the how there, it forces you to have a thesis statement that means something. I don't want to discuss what happens. I want to discuss how Qureshi proves, you see, that personal growth is necessarily determined by social influences. That's one way to paraphrase it. Or, I want to show how Qureshi's narrative is structured in such a way as to invite the reader to question the correlation between personal growth and social influence. Do you see the how? I want to show how the narrative invites us to think in a particular way. I want to examine how a philosophical or an ideological position is written into the narrative. It's the how that's important. Okay. Once you've got that paraphrase, that is your thesis statement. That's the mission statement. That's what you're going to set out to do. And that's the most precious thing that you can generate before you start doing research. If you don't have this, you can't do research, because what will you be researching? Unless you know where you're going, you don't know what to look for. You don't know which road to take. Philosophical. Okay, so the paraphrase is your working thesis statement. Now, we don't go to the library yet. We go back to the primary text. And we look at the notes that we made when we were reading it, asking the critical questions. If I'm going to show how the text is establishing a correlation between personal development and social influence, look at the notes you made when you asked, what is being set up as normative? Is that norm being seen as oppressive to personal development or as enabling to personal development? It's the text that contains the answers, not the library, not the theorists. The theorists are used to generate ideas, not to give you the answers. Okay. So you ask, are there any clues, are there any hints in the primary text that I can use? And most importantly, you generate questions about your thesis statement. These are the questions that you take to the library, research questions they're called. So you look at the primary text and you say, in order for me to show how personal development is correlated with social institutions, what social institutions are there in this text? The school, the home, society, history, the narratives of history, narratives of the past. What institutions, what is being sold to these people as a framework to think about themselves? Now, I need to ask questions about what research do I need to enrich this reading? Research is only there to satisfy a need. It's not there to offer answers. So you come up with three or four questions. Those are the questions that are going to structure your argument. And I'm going to talk about dialectical analysis in a minute, because this is how we construct arguments, using questions, answers, synthesis. Now you go to the library. You don't need hours and days in the library. I've been up in the library when you've had deadlines. It's shocking. I mean, it's like a pub. You don't go to the library and spend the whole day. What are you doing in the whole day? If you know what you're looking for, find it, go home, write the essay, get on with your life. Why are you in the library for hours? There is nothing there. It's just boring, silent people. Librarians are bored of the library. Don't spend hours in the library. You need a couple of hours on JSTOR. You get a few articles, something you don't understand. You look it up, a historical fact you're looking for. Don't use Wikipedia. There's history books. Look Look at facts, answer questions, get on with your life. The library has no answers. The library is an evil place because it can eat. Look at the books. They rot in libraries. You don't want that. You want to finish the essay. Get on with it. Okay. So when you applied an extension to me, don't say, I've been in the library for days. That's not a good excuse for getting an extension. Okay. Critical reading now. We've gone to the library, collected 5 or 6 articles, no more, to read them, to get an insight. When we read those critical essays, we are not looking for answers to the essay title. We are looking for supporting evidence. We already know what we're looking for because it's all in the primary text. The only time I want to see quotations in the essay from secondary sources is because they support your argument, a couple of lines, or because you found something outrageous and you want to engage with it. For example, you found that there was a decade in the 70s where everybody was discussing Angela Carter as a pornographic artist. And there was. There were 10 years where everybody thought, oh my God, these novels are all about pornography. And you find this, you disagree with this opinion. Great. You put it in there, you summarize what these critics have said in a couple of lines, and then you react to it. That's why I want to see critics. They support what you're saying in a couple of lines, or you want to engage with what they're saying, disagree with them, talk about how their ideas are outdated, talk about how these ideas belong to a particular phase of our critical thinking. That's the only reason you want them there. Okay? Good. And this is like a strategy to deal with secondary sources, because we don't want them, just like the theorists don't tell you how to think, we don't want them to tell you how to think. The first thing you do is determine the central claim, because every article is trying, has a thesis, just like your essay has a thesis. That central claim, when you want to discuss the article in your own essay, and you say, according to Boris Johnson or something, pardon? Boris Johnson, you know, Blondie. I just use him because he's got a great name. According to Boris Johnson, Angela Carter says blah, blah, blah. Before you do that, don't just suddenly hit me with a critic in the middle of your argument. Where did this guy come from? Critics are guests. Before they come in, introduce them, make me feel receptive towards them. According to Boris Johnson, in an article on blah, 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 in which he claims that, give me a central, I know why, where this quote comes in. He could be arguing something completely opposite to what you're saying. You're taking the quote out of context, and that is to the detriment of your argument. So according to Boris Johnson, in his article, blah, 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 where he claims that, blah, 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 then you give me the quote, so I know in which context he said the quote. But then, of course, don't leave them hanging in the lounge, right? You bring in the guest, sit them down, and then you start, you know, engaging with them. Engage with the critics. If you're not going to engage with them, keep them out. Don't open the door. I don't want to see them. Not interested. Yeah? Central claim. Then you ask questions. Who was it written for? In what context was this essay written? What kind of evidence is being used? If the essay is relying solely, that's the critical essay, if it's relying solely on historical evidence, you know it's new historicist. You know it's leaving out a lot of other evidence. Critique that. If the essay is only relying on the diary of a particular author, to make a case to say, well, actually, this author was very politically committed, fine. Make a point to say, well, the evidence is only taken from her diary. And of course, most importantly, what is missing? So Boris Johnson, in his article, blah, 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 says this. Great, I'm going to engage with him. But what he doesn't say is this. What is missing from his claim is this. Only when you can engage fully with the critic do you cite them. Don't just bring in random people into the essay. Yeah? Wasn't that a good metaphor? Good? Okay. Brilliant. Critical thinking, which is what you're going to use to write the essay, is about the relationship of the text you're reading, the novel, the poem, the essay title, and the secondary sources. This is how you construct an argument. It's not only I'm going to have a paragraph where I analyze characters, then I'm going to have a paragraph where I define the key terms from the essay title, then another paragraph where I review what everybody has said, and then I have a paragraph where I give my own opinion, and then point final, goodbye. What is that? That's madness. What I want is an essay that says, I've got this primary text here, you've asked me a question, I've done some research, bring it all together, me comes in, and me writes the essay, which brings all of this together. Don't write essays where each paragraph does a different thing. That's madness. I know Ginsberg would like that, but I don't. Okay, so the criteria are relevance, logical structure, personal response and evaluation, and using text in critics. This is the last thing I'm going to do, okay? Ever. Relevance. If you're given a question like the one we examined earlier, you don't really have to worry too much about relevance, because if you decode it properly, you've identified the primary text, you've identified the keywords, you've looked at the correlation, you've generated a thesis statement based on that primary text. But sometimes the questions are broad, like the theory questions we ask. Okay, what do you do then? The first thing you do is you identify what the scope and limitations of your essay will be. If I'm telling you in the essay title, I want you to write on Buddha, that's great. That is the scope, that's how broadly you're writing, but that's also the limitation. You're only going to write about Buddha. It's a very short essay you're writing anyway. If I don't say that, if the essay title is broad, what is literature and all those, you know, crazy questions, that's all right. Scope and limitations. Before you do anything else, you say, this essay is going to deal with these critics, this primary text. You give a reason why these are the ideal people to use. And then you set the limitations. It's going to examine the following questions, but it will not examine questions of race, questions of gender, questions of class, because you give me a reason why. That's how you make sure that everything you're writing is relevant to the question, because you define it, you narrow it down. Okay. Dialectical analysis. This is how you're going to structure your essay. Logical structure. Do you know about dialectical analysis? No? Nobody did philosophy? Okay. Dialectical analysis is a way of constructing arguments. It's a very simple way of... it's a simple structure, but it's not a simple way of constructing arguments. It requires a lot of hard work. What you do is you have a thesis. And this can work for the whole argument or for each paragraph. Okay. A thesis, a point you want to make. Then a counterpoint. You react to it, and then you generate the synthesis. That's dialectical analysis. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. So, in my argument, I have my thesis statement. Very good. I'm going to get very self-absorbed, going to go to the library, and I'm going to prove my thesis. My argument is going to make a point, provide evidence, and prove the thesis. Very good. That's not enough. Because in order for me to be a critical thinker, a critical writer, I need to also assess the validity of my own argument. So once I have demonstrated that in this novel, individual growth is linked to social institutions, that's great, then I ask, but what else? But so what? What is the counterpoint? What is missing from this novel? What is missing from my argument? What could I not argue because the novel doesn't give me clues for? So, for example, in Angela Carter's novel, I may write a fantastic essay talking about economic dependence in this family, and I may analyze the reasons for it, I may analyze the historical reasons for it, I make a big deal about 1967, it's a cultural moment where Carter could not envisage a future of economic independence for women. Okay, I make all of these. Excellent point. And then, what's the counter-argument? What is still missing from this? What could I not argue? Well, there's a lot I couldn't argue. I couldn't argue, for example, what happened in her family home. Because in her family home, the structure I've just described of economic dependence wouldn't work. And I have Mrs. Rundle. She's economically independent, but I can't do much with her because the novel abandons her. That's what's missing from the novel. There are, around the main argument, there are arguments waiting to be made that I can't make. And that is what limits my own argument. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Of course, all our arguments are limited because we can only work with what's in the novel. So I can see possibilities for talking about a different way of thinking of economic development. But I can't talk about them because the novel doesn't seem to develop them, doesn't seem to be interested in them. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And antithesis is not really like, you know, the enemy of the thesis. Antithesis is the counterpoint, the other point. So you make a point, you develop it, you illustrate it, evaluate it, wonderful. And then you ask, but what else? And so what? And how is this important? And what is missing? So the synthesis in your essay comes either at the conclusion or at the end of a nice chunk of argument where you say, look, here's the question I've been given. That would be a nice conclusion. Here's the question I've been given. Here's how I've paraphrased it. I found evidence to support my thesis, but what is missing is this. And the synthesis is, so what's the big picture? What is this novel saying about this particular period? What is this poem saying about the Beat Generation? What is this novel saying about the condition of England, about the war, post-war, about being a hybrid growing up in England? What are these novels saying? And once you've done that, you submit the essay, but you only submit it after you've followed guidelines, such as double spacing, ID number, not your name, don't want to know your name, ID number on the essay, page numbers, MLA, have we harassed you enough about MLA or do you want more? Shall I like email you every day? MLA, MLA, please use MLA, otherwise we're going to deduct 2 marks from every essay. Nice bibliography, put quotation marks when you borrow other people's words, and you submit it to the English department next term, happily. Is that all right? Useful? Tomorrow, between 10 and 2, if you would like to talk to me, not instead of talking to your seminar tutor, I'll be in my office, no need to book, door open, 10 and 2, you can come talk to me about your second Moser Reading essays. And tonight, if you fancy a drink, we're going to be at Bar Fusion from 6:30 onwards. I'm not going to talk about work or studying. I'm going to be not myself. So if you want to come and have a drink with us, do so. Okay, well, I hope you've enjoyed Moser Reading. Yeah. 539. Okay, everybody. Have a lovely Easter. Bye. Thank you.